So what is the status of the tests and trials for treatments or cures for COVID-19? Our next guest says it's so chaotic it makes his heart ache, with more than 94 trials for the antimalarial drug hydroxychloroquine alone. The same goes for clinical trials around the world for other treatments, hundreds of them with a lack of coordination that's causing duplication and lost time. And then there are the trials themselves. How do you convince doctors and their very sick patients to participate when there's a 50% chance they're getting a placebo, not a lifesaver? That's a hard sell. Derek Angus chairs the Department of Critical Care Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. He's leading a trial that will test multiple drugs and therapies at once. It's part of an international effort. We're going to get to that. But Dr. Angus, Professor Derek, welcome.
Thanks very much.
And you have said it's a cacophony, not an orchestra. There's no conductor. But I can hear people outside your world saying, well, 94 trials for, you know, chloroquine, the more the merrier. So why not that thinking?
So first of all, it's not because people aren't well-meaning. People have ideas and they think, hey, I should test this idea. This disease brings about in people a huge passion to try to fix the problem. The problem is that the way clinical research works, we aren't in peacetime, if you like. We have hundreds of drugs to test, but because there wasn't one large coordinated effort, to a certain extent, it behaves almost like a marketplace where everyone is trying to lobby to have their idea heard. So, for example, investigators, drug companies are all knocking on the door of every hospital or large academic medical center saying, please do my study. My study is most important. And it instantly put the whole world into a position of trying to choose. It's like this massive cottage industry.
The Washington Post reports that the National Institutes of Health, led by Francis Collins, is recognizing this problem. He is planning a global public-private partnership, including pharmaceutical companies, academic research centers, but it's been under wraps because they're trying to get people to buy in. How hard is it to ask companies to maybe put aside potential revenues from their project to back somebody else's, countries to put aside their national pride to be the first, researchers to share what they may know? How hard is that?
So you said it really well. So first of all, I think it's fantastic that Francis Collins is doing this. We really need to try to get everyone in a room, try to overcome tribalism. Our system was built for a good reason. Federal funding agencies tend to fund national projects because they're responsible to their taxpayers. Investigators that work at universities do have some responsibility to the universities, and pharmaceutical companies are in a marketplace in competition with each other. So there are legitimate barriers to one effective large collaboration. So I think what Francis is tackling is totally the right thing to do. How it works out is going to be interesting.
I'm imagining there's another question of buy-in, because you point out that there are 2.5 million cases of COVID-19 worldwide, but fewer than 2,000 people in clinical trials. You told CNN that if even 1 in 10 had been able to participate in a trial, we might have had 100 different drugs by now. But I'm wondering if patients are not participating because in these trials, it's a 50% chance of getting the drug. Others get the placebo. And with this deadly disease, maybe patients don't want to do it.
That's right. Clinical research has to partner with clinical care. And traditionally, a lot of clinical research designs, it almost felt like a choice. You can either take care of the patient or you can test the drug. And that's in part because some of the designs that are best for testing the drug don't feel very friendly towards taking care of the patient. And at the heart of it, no one wants to be a guinea pig. So study designs that are 50-50 chance of getting the drug, they don't feel like they're leaning in to the needs of the patient and the doctor at the bedside. When you get down to the nitty-gritty of it, people who are busy just struggling to find PPE and feeling overwhelmed and try, and they have a patient who's sick right in front of them, they're thinking, I need to do something now to care for the patient, and don't bother me with all this research stuff.
Well, Dr. Angus, let's get to what you are doing, because it answers a little bit of that. It's a fast-track REMAP trial, it's called. It's modeled on something you did in 2009 during the H1N1 pandemic. Every patient gets something that might work, and you're testing combinations of drugs together. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're testing?
Sure. So first of all, you talked about 2009. So that's when it first dawned on us that the traditional randomized trial is really hard to get off the ground and run efficiently in a pandemic. And that led a bunch of us around the world to start thinking about trial designs that would be more flexible. And the special adaptive platform trial we most wanted to try was something called a REMAP, which is randomized, trying to test multiple options all at the same time. That's like choosing a starter, a main course, and a dessert all at the same time. And only one of each of these is usual care. And so if you have three starters, three main courses, and three desserts, that's actually 27 choices, and only one of the 27 choices does not include at least some active therapy. So what happens there is nearly everyone is getting the opportunity to try something that we think will help. The other thing we do in the design is the trial learns as it goes. And so you might start off with a 1 in 27 chance for every combination, but the combinations that are doing best get a bigger and bigger share of the pie over time.
Okay, so let me ask you something, because somebody might be hearing you and thinking, well, you know, we just heard that there are hundreds of trials around the world. Maybe he's just selling his trial. If you were to find out, it turns out there's someone in Italy who's doing the same thing, only maybe getting, you know, maybe a little bit ahead of you, would you be willing to fold your program at Pittsburgh into theirs, or to stop yours altogether?
Yeah, so it's a great point. I totally lie in bed at night and tell myself, okay, so if I'm a team player, I should be prepared to surrender my ideas too. I have lots of opinions about which drugs I think might work best. I've ended up deciding to not even voice my opinions, but rather tried to really just think more about what's a trial design that can be as modular as possible and let as many people in as possible. The REMAP program that we put out in Pittsburgh is actually tied into an international effort that involves hundreds of investigators. And there's no question that we have to do some compromising for the joint good. And so our trial is actually enrolling in London, and we're just about to bring on some Italian sites, and we enroll across Europe and Australia and Canada, and that's totally the goal.
Well, good for you. I mean, you that you put both thoughts out there. But just, can I do a lightning round with you real quick, if you can? Are you seeing anything promising about remdesivir, which attacks parts of the cells?
So remdesivir has been studied in its own trials with Gilead, and that's consequently made it very hard for anyone to actually get access to remdesivir outside their trials. And so I'm like the rest of the world, waiting to see the results of those trials. There have been some preliminary reports suggesting, for example, that severe patients in Chicago did better than they might have expected, but there's no control group there. And then there's been another study that was accidentally released that was then covered in the New York Times suggesting, oh, maybe it looks like it didn't work. I think at this point, remdesivir, we simply don't know.
Quickly again, convalescent plasma, this is drawing blood with antibodies in it from people who've fought off COVID-19 to give that blood to boost the immune system of people who are very sick?
Yes. So convalescent plasma is a very important step. It's a slightly crude way of taking advantage of the human host's own antibodies to the infection. And so there are issues about whether convalescent plasma is made in exactly the same way from place to place, but that will be one of the first highly specific interventions against COVID-19. We would then expect it to be replaced by more specific synthetic immunoglobulins that hopefully will come in the summer. And we're testing, for example, convalescent plasma in our program.
Very exciting to hear that that could be replicated, the antibodies in the blood. That's Derek Angus, chair of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Department of Critical Care, running their research there into cures or treatments for COVID-19, but also asking, as many others are, for a global approach. Dr. Angus, Professor Derek, best of luck to you. We all await what you find. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And we mentioned the drug remdesivir. Well, just today, Dr. Anthony Fauci said there is good news on that front. Drug maker Gilead released data saying that patients, COVID-19 patients, recovered 4 days sooner on remdesivir than those who were not taking it. He says this proves the drug can block this virus, although another study from China was inconclusive. So have you or a loved one been part of a clinical trial? Do you think you or they benefited or felt like guinea pigs? We'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org.